This is Art Hovey. It's May 16th, 2007, and I'm with Hank Loeffler, and we're continuing our discussions. Last time we talked about when Hank went up to the Chancellor's office and began working with David Ward and some of the relationships that developed with regard to fundraising and dealing with donors. But obviously there were a lot of other concerns that you had to deal with when you, the two of you, began to deal with the issues of the university on a day-to-day and long-range basis.
Well, and it'll be hard in the future to be listening to this discussion because to a certain extent the way the office was structured when I was there really related to the kinds of things that were coming in on a daily basis and how you needed to be prepared for them. And it also related in part when I first went there to the system that I inherited, because there was a system in place caused a series of colored file folders to circulate on a daily basis, and you probably remember colored file folders from when you were in the Chancellor's office.
No, we all kept it on little pieces of paper.
Well, the mail would come into the Chancellor's office and it would be sorted by the receptionist into things which looked important and things which didn't look important, which is usually easy to identify because you get the Chronicle of Higher Education and all these newspapers, and you get mailings from all of the groups the university belongs to, which are legion, and you would get individual correspondence that came in that some of it was of the to whom it may concern variety, and some of it was directly to the Chancellor. And so decisions were being made constantly over who would respond to those issues and who would respond to the correspondence, and it would go in various colored folders. As I recall, the pink folder was not very important, and there were blue and red folders and other colors that meant a great deal more, which required immediate attention or whatnot. But we would log in that correspondence, and when I say we, that's the royal we, because Cindy Haas, who was keeping track of the correspondence and presumably still is in the Chancellor's office, would in effect give every item a number, and we would be referring things to, you know, to the Dean of Letters and Science to reply to a question about letters and science, and please copy the Chancellor, or please write a letter for the Chancellor. There were various options here where, gosh, it's a legislator, the Chancellor better respond, but he doesn't know anything about this, so we would have somebody else write the letter. All of these things are logged in, and of course every letter is important to the person who sent it, and so you're trying not to lose track of anything, but at any one time you might have 200 or 300 letters out there being prepared by somebody or other, either for the Chancellor or to reply directly and send us a copy so that we know the person heard from somebody. Some of those letters would come in that were drafted by somebody else, and they simply didn't sound like the Chancellor, or they didn't appear to be written in a style that the Chancellor would recognize. And so then, in many instances, I would take those letters and simply rewrite them so that it sounded like the Chancellor, because after I was up there a year or so, we got so that I could write a letter that sounded just like the Chancellor, and we weren't that different probably to begin with. So we would produce correspondence that went back out. The Chancellor always wanted to see every piece of mail that came in, and we, of course, allowed him to do that. Most of the stuff was coming through and was in the category of junk mail, and so after he got done looking at them, we would throw it out. Others were filed away in file cabinets. We also had a code word in the office, which was if a staff member received a note stapled to a piece of correspondence that said, "Please handle directly," that meant one of two things. Either this was the oddest letter that you would ever look at, in which case it was sent to that person for them to smile at, but it wasn't really a serious "please handle directly," or it was something the person did for a living, in which case "please handle directly" meant just take this, I don't ever want to see it again, don't send us a copy, just take care of it. Do whatever you want to, throw it out, reply, whatever you want. So you had those kinds. But we had a rather substantial file folder labeled odds, and the odds letters included notes from people who claimed that the university had invented something which was now buzzing in their left ear, or these kinds of these kinds of letters that would suggest that the person was not of sound mind, and we would, or they would contain obscene drawings, or they were from prisons, or who knows where you get this great outpouring of letters. So basically, that's correspondence, and it was handled in a very methodical, and I'm sure anybody listening to this conversation would doze off during the discussion, because basically it's handled in a very reasonable way, and everybody heard something. The real question comes when you get a series of telephone calls coming in of people demanding to speak to the chancellor, and the extent to which they might be willing to listen to other people is always an issue, and I wound up with a lot of those phone calls of distraught parents or whoever it is, and, you know, and I would say, the chancellor's not here, but maybe I can take care of this for you. What is the problem? And they would tell you, and then you would try to figure out what was the best way to handle it, and oftentimes that was getting Mary Rouse or Roger Howard or somebody in the Dean of Students office to talk to parents, because both of those individuals were extremely adroit at being able to handle difficult situations. And if we had a student come into the office who was distraught for some reason or other, we would send somebody down the back stairs to get Roger Howard and interrupt him and bring him back upstairs to help deal with that situation. Presenting in the front office and the chancellor's office were all sorts of people, sort of like the governor's office or the mayor's office, where you get people who are extremely upset about something and they come in. And sometimes you just need to go out to the reception area and sit down with them and really talk to them for a fair amount of time before they calm down and you could figure out what it was that they really wanted. And other times, not very often, but occasionally we would get very strange people coming in. And under our desks in the chancellor's office were buttons that connected directly with the university police that you would press if something went wrong. And there was also an old-fashioned doorbell underneath the desk of the receptionist. And if the receptionist felt that they needed a little company up there in the front room to deal with somebody, because oftentimes people will be very abusive of one person sitting alone, but when you get three people who come in and stand there with the person, they become less abusive. So we had a protocol that called for pressing the doorbell if you needed to have some company, and the doorbell would go off and everybody would get up and run into the front room. The whole question of the security of the chancellor's office, because of its location, in effect sitting out on the prow of a ship, right at the very edge of the building with doors, three or four doors leading into it off of public corridors, and with only a sign marked private, do not enter, on the door as the means of keeping people out of the chancellor's office, because otherwise you could just blast right through the door. I suppose it was surprising that nothing really untoward happened in that office, because the chancellor really is sitting there in a very exposed location. And as occasionally we would get protest movements that would sweep it toward the office, you became conscious of the fact that the chancellor's office was very hard to keep people out of if you needed to do that. It was a very exposed place. Though during the entire time, the 8 years or so that I was there, we had one protest that succeeded in taking over the reception area, but then it never got into the chancellor's office, which has a door off of the reception area, or into the rest of the office. During one of those protests, students were trying to break in the door downstairs, which connected to the hallway. But those doors are solid core doors, and they're pretty well hinged. And though they were running 2x4s like a battering ram at the door, it didn't give way, and the police at that point were using mace to get the students to back up, because they were they were really preventing staff from leaving the office, which was the intention at that time, was to use the downstairs doorway to allow the secretaries to leave, and students were trying to get in while they were trying to leave, and we had a sufficient police force so that we were able to keep them back enough so that the women were able to get out of the office. But that was an unpleasant day. And generally the windows at that time all were plexiglass, so you couldn't break the glass, the storm windows, which is still the case in the chancellor's office. Anyway, I digress off into office safety, but we did have those protocols and a system to handle all of these various issues that came along. What evolved into my job was really trying to figure out, as you get a major emergency, let's just say there appears to be somebody who has embezzled money, or there appears to be something that is unusual has happened, or we're getting reports, misbehavior by a faculty member or a staff member that might involve a student or might involve a subordinate, or these kinds of things develop in very large institutions. Or you might get an issue that comes along that relates to a legislative issue, where all of a sudden there is concern over rising tuition, and can we think of some way to respond to those levels, to those kinds of concerns. And basically, in consultation with the chancellor, what we did was to create what I would call response teams. So it was not so much that the chancellor was involved or that I was involved necessarily in every issue that came along, but you needed to get somebody from campus communications so that if this became a public matter, everybody would know what it was about. And then if it involved a legal matter, you'd have to get one of the attorneys, and almost everything involved a legal matter. And then you would say, well, gee, we better get the Dean of Letters and Science here because for some reason or other there might be a need for that person to be involved. And so what I would basically do then is create a task force that would handle something and make all of the people on that task force come to my office, and we would sit around the table, and usually on short notice. You were calling people out of meetings and making them come to you, which generally speaking was not the highlight of their day, when they would get a phone call saying, geez, I hate to interrupt you, but I really need you here. So they would come, and we would talk through what we appeared to know or didn't know, and then various people would be charged with going out to gather more information and coming back again tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock, or, you know, gather. Or sometimes we would have, in the case of something that appeared to be a problem, for example, at a forthcoming football game, we'd have somebody from athletics, and we'd have the police chief, and we'd have the dean of students, and we'd pull together this group of people and say, okay, no, we are not going to search the students for contraband. Yes, we are going to do the following, and ask them to open their purses and open their jackets, and we will be throwing beer and vodka bottles into that dumpster over there, and we're going to throw out people under certain circumstances, but we're not going to do random strip searches, or, you know, you talk your way through what are the various responses, and you kind of come up with, you know, a possible resolution of that. And that all of that kind of work was done, ideally anyway. Sometimes things would sneak up on you and you had to do the best you could, but ideally you would have time to formulate, you know, a strategy based on what this group suggested. And sometimes these issues were discussed in the chancellor's group, and here's a more deliberative structure. Over time, David Ward had, as previous chancellors did, a staff meeting that would, and there were two kinds of staff meetings. One kind almost never happened, which is to call together all the people who work in the chancellor's office and talk about something. And then there was the kind of staff meeting with what we call the chancellor's group. The chancellor's group had a very fixed membership, and of course many, many more people wanted to come to that meeting than the table in the chancellor's office held. When John Wiley became chancellor, so many people wanted to come to the Chancellor's group meeting that he accommodated that, and they began meeting upstairs, and it got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And ultimately it wasn't, it ultimately was a different meeting altogether. When we had it, the Chancellor's group, everybody fitted around a conference table which holds approximately a dozen people. You might have occasional visitors who would come to one meeting and not every meeting. But otherwise, the group included the provost and the vice chancellor for administration. And eventually when the provost had a chief of staff, it included that person, who ultimately was Casey Nagy, working with John Wiley, who ultimately took my job. And then there were, the Dean of Students was there, and the Dean of Letters and Science, because that represented the largest student undergraduate college, and that was important. And we had the Dean of the Graduate School. And let's see, who else was there? Melanie Newby, who was at that time the Vice Chancellor for Legal, came to those meetings. And I did, and Susan Treback, who at that time was the head of campus communications, was always at that meeting, and or somebody from her staff. Sometimes both Susan and Amy Tavirin, or somebody from her staff, depending on what the issues were. Because almost every issue was legal, and almost every issue was public relations, and so we would...
Police represent?
Not on a regular basis, no. Actually, very rarely did a policing issue come up. Certainly it did after the crowd surge, and then the aftermath of that, and whether or not we would search students, which was a real proposal that was made by the chief of police and by the dean of students, which John Torfey and I think probably were most vocal in saying that was a stupid idea. We didn't want to just randomly search everybody. We wanted to at least have some individual suspicion that there was some reason to ask that student to open their coat before we did it. Or that they would, people would now what we consider routine, you're going into the stadium and you hold out your purse, or you hold out your whatever you're carrying in, and you open your coat and you go on in. But at that time it seemed like a much bigger issue. But anyway, that was the group, and it was sort of it really was people who had major responsibilities for playing with the issue of the day, whatever it might be. And loosely, the Chancellor's group would meet every 2 weeks. And I'm holding in front of me the Chancellor's group agendas for, it appears to be the Chancellor's group from the start of the 96-97 year, and there was already a previous Chancellor's group book, and this went through to the last Chancellor's group meeting that I did for John Wiley on January 9th of 2001, after John Wiley had taken over as Chancellor. And they are, and clearly by 96 we had already a fully functioning group. So here is here are the agenda items for the July 23rd meeting, 1996. Tuition remission, eliminating tuition remission surcharge for all graduate students, which is still an issue on this campus right to the very day, 10 years later. And that was Virginia Hinshaw. She was then the dean of the graduate school. That was her issue. The Thailand situation did not refer to foreign policy. It referred to a very difficult personnel case involving a faculty member and a staff member who found themselves together in Thailand in too many ways. And John Wiley was talking about 4-year graduation contract, which is still an issue today. John Torfey was talking about efficiencies, as the agenda said, which was a code word for some of the units that we might be wishing to close. There was a proposal from Foley and Lardner to legally represent the athletic program as a pro bono gift to the university, which, as I recall, didn't come to pass. A And then there was an athletic personnel matter, which was a real big one, because I think a whole lot of sportswear went missing. And then there was the Reebok contract. Now, of course, that's a sweatshop issue. It's basically an athletic issue again, the whole question of apparel contracts. And then, as a special item of business, Casey Nagy talked about student websites at 9:45 after the meeting had been underway for 45 minutes, and that was a time certain because a whole bunch of legal staff came in to talk about it. And that really had to do with students expropriating materials off of the web without royalty payments, and that's still an issue today. But it also had to do with, shall we say, some racy student websites that might have the capacity to embarrass the university. So those are 9 items on one meeting on one week, some of which obviously are reoccurring issues because, like we just said, things like apparel contracts and graduation contracts and personnel matters and so forth really continued down to the present time. But it was within this group that those matters were discussed openly and some resolution was sought. And in some instances, I would be responsible for the follow-up to an issue, and in other cases, other people would be. But then I would meet after the chancellor's group meeting. I would walk out of that meeting and walk into a meeting with the chancellor's office staff so that they would know what the... And that might include the state relations, it might include federal, depending on the issues of the day. It certainly it included the immediate office staff, because the people who were answering the telephones and opening the mail needed to know that we were about to enter into a personnel action over in athletics, and people might be calling about that, or they might be calling about the Reebok contract, or whatever it is. And in an office where you handle such a diverse sort of ocean of these kinds of issues, it's important that even the receptionist, that everybody know that we may be dealing with something that's going to bring a lot of people into the office about something, or people may be calling from various places and they should be put through to various office staff members. And it was just useful for the staff in general to see how we were responding to some of these, because they worked there and they would have to know something about it, so that it would be possible then for somebody who regularly attends these meetings to come in and say to one of the staff members, did David send out the letter yet about the something or other? And they would know what he was talking about. So we had this kind of, I guess you would call this a management structure. And that's one of, I mean, every 2 weeks this list would be generated, and sometimes there were, let's just go one more thing and see what, okay, here's November of 96. And we were talking on that day about wharf royalties and the consideration of changes in the distribution of the funds. So I guess you would say that was a that was a good one. That was a management issue. Casey Nagy talked about the use of student social security numbers, which is still an issue on the campus today, though generally we've gotten away from them. The Purdue mascot incident. I remember this one very well. As I recall, somebody in the UW band blew a horn in the ear of the Purdue mascot and caused the mascot to have a ruptured eardrum or something like that. It was another one of those. It was a misconduct case, and I may have got it wrong. An update on restructuring athletic concessions, out-of-state student housing, and some juvenile crime in university housing. And then attached to this meeting of the chancellor's group was the university relations team meeting minutes, so that this group was informed that what all of the people who did university relations was doing, and vice versa, so that some of these issues that were going to become were discussed with the university relations team. So we were structuring it in such a way that...
Would that be that meeting subsequent to your meeting? University relations?
University relations University Relations was in the off weeks, so the Chancellor's group met every 2 weeks, and the University Relations team met every 2 weeks, but they were on different, they were on alternating weeks. So that because the University Relations team included a variety of managers from across the campus, but it generally included the person most senior in university relations in the schools and colleges, and at the hospital, and at athletics, and at the WAA, and at the foundation. So we had a structure where, I guess you would call it the far-flung enterprise, the biggest units therein anyway, because all the schools and colleges were represented, as were our corporate affiliates like the foundation and the alumni association and the hospital, which at that time belonged to us but later on didn't for matters of both convenience and financial reasons. So the university relations team then was the PR people in effect for each one of those major units, and they were longtime academic staff for the most part who, so that we were trying to make sure in this structure then that there was a sense, first of all, that everybody was knitted together, and of course you wouldn't discuss particulars of these cases, personnel cases or whatnot, but when it came to the non-personnel cases that would be of interest to somebody from the rest of the enterprise, then that was the communication network that went back and forth. And so there was an effort being made here to have what I would call a series of institutional messages that were understood, at least what the messages were. It's not that we would expect deans and directors and everybody else to suddenly start sounding just like the chancellor on an issue. But at least they knew for the senior kinds of messages, those that might be the ones that we had selected to deal with the legislature and the public in the coming year, that were going to be themes of materials that were mailed out to people around the state and to editorial boards and so forth. New student initiatives, new this, new that. There were a series of messages then that everybody knew what they were. So that there was it's a very large place with the numbers of people that we have and all of these operations, and it was a good idea for people to understand what we were all about. Do you want to do one more agenda, Art? Can you stand it to see if anything changed?
No, let's go back. Let's go on quite a bit now.
Okay, let's.
A couple years beyond.
How about, let's go 2 years. Here's February of 98. Emergency aid for Far East students. This had to do in 1998 with the declining worldwide economic climate and the fact that it was causing parents and others who were supporting Far East students on the campus to be unable to do so because their economies were so terrible. Of course, now these people are paying us, or we're paying them. And then 10 years later, things have really changed. But at that time, that was what that was about. Virginia Hinshaw now was talking about monkeys. And the whole question of the use of the vilest monkeys and in research. John Torvey was talking about LTEs, the whole question of limited term employees. Black Law Student Association was complaining about various things. And we had a Board of Regents meeting to get ready for, where we had a couple of different difficult building projects on the agenda. So that was 1998. In some ways, February 3rd, 1998, in some ways, the following meeting to that one, we were figuring out what the proposal was to restructure the violence trust and how we should be using those additional monies. Monkeys again. Advanced Opportunity Fellow strategy, that was also of concern. Should we have or not have a public utility institute in the School of Business? That was a rather substantial.
Do we?
Yes. Yes, we do. the Madison Idea Foundation's Missing Pieces of Museum Row project. Phil Certain was talking about that because it had to do with the expansion of what is now the Chazen Museum. So, I was talking about the Chancellor's Group when we flipped the tape over. What's interesting about the Chancellor's Group is that it is basically what's going on in the Chancellor's office at the time. So for the really big issues, personnel matters or whatever it is. So if you really wanted to know what was occupying the Chancellor's time, it would be these things. I would point out that there's very little going on here that really has much to do with the undergraduate instructional program, or what I would call the liberal arts university. Phil Certain is sitting there. Phil Certain was not a modest dean. If he had something to say, he would certainly lean forward and say it. The fact that he's not represented on too many of these items suggests that most of these items are coming out of either tensions with regard to funding, which is what you see with the dean of the graduate school always talking about tuition remissions and these kinds of things. If we were looking at September minutes of the Chancellor's Group, the Dean of Letters and Science would be talking about the need for additional money from the central campus because, as always, we admitted too many students and therefore he needs more section money for the various important freshman level courses that need to be staffed if students are going to finish their degrees in anything related to ordinary time. We would always have that sort of most a traditional discussion in the fall of how do we provide for additional students. And then, of course, at the end of the year, we'd be turning the dial on students with regard to how many transfer students we admit, because that was the way we always kept the population stable. So you'd be kind of dialing both the beginning and the end of the year on students. But basically, many of these issues, if not most of these issues, have to do with issues that are, in some cases, cutting across the academic and bureaucratic and research parts of the university. So you're really dealing with issues here that no one would think that the Dean of Letters and Science should handle alone, or the Dean of Engineering, or anybody else. You look at these things and you're saying, no, we have to, you know, emergency aid for Far East students or whatever it is that are coming up on these agendas are really something that strikes the university as a whole, and they're not susceptible to discussion and settling in one college.
And they're articulated by outside forces quite often, so that you have to respond institutionally. But in the meantime, there's that whole dimension of the university that goes on a regular day-to-day basis, and people are performing their duties to follow through on that, and this is more oriented towards resolving issues at a higher level so they don't trickle down to the lower level. Is that correct?
I would say so. Or they are, if they're at a local level, like a personnel matter or the School of Business Public Utility Institute, they are capable of arousing sentiments that would be felt in the Chancellor's office institution-wide, even though it's just occurring in a college. Okay. Or there's some awful personnel thing or whatever that is just going to be terrible to deal with, because legislators don't understand the university particularly well, but they do understand when somebody is philandering, and they're more than happy to offer ad hominem advice when one of those cases comes along.
In fact, they're just laying in the weeds waiting.
In fact, they have their public press releases already written.
Right.
And they just fill in
the blanks.
I am shocked and dismayed by philandering sociologist. And they write it in. So that's what this group is dealing with. I had the occasion when I was reflecting on these minutes to go back and look at the minutes for the Faculty Senate and for the Academic Staff Assembly for the same period of time. And it will come as no surprise to you, Art, that these three groups are living in different planets. They had, other than an occasional reference to the state budget, which of course everybody cares about, or parking, which everybody cares about, these groups were really dealing with completely different matters.
But it reflects the enormous complexity of the institution and how matters have to be resolved by the appropriate components of the institution, unless, as you suggest, they become more matters of concern to a larger public, which needs to be educated and informed, and the issues need to be resolved in that
way. And if you went down to the school and college level, you would discover that basically that is the home of home cooking, if you will, and those are just basically dealing with issues that relate to a college.
Yes.
So you would have personnel matters that relate to that college, but presumably don't contain elements of scandal, and then you would have all of these other kinds of issues that relate to the curriculum. It's interesting that people would, of course, imagine that the chancellor is sitting around thinking lofty ideas and is planning for the future of undergraduate education in America, if not more.
Or the other part of it is that the chancellor is all-powerful and he can issue an edict and everybody will be forced then to follow through. Is that correct?
Yes, people would perhaps imagine that.
Yeah.
And or how could the chancellor let this happen, which is always one of my favorite lines, when we have 20,000 employees or 18,000 employees, and how could the chancellor possibly let that person named Art Hovey misbehave?
Right.
And you know, so
a lot of people have asked that question.
So it's interesting to look at this because people go off and get PhDs and become adroit and actually become chancellors, either because they can raise money or because they think good academic thoughts, and then all of a sudden they find that actually what they're doing is trying to keep a lot of issues from interfering with what is really the purpose of the university.
Now,
which
going back to your earlier narrative with regard to the dean's office, similar things happen at that level too, that are quite the same in how they have to be handled as they are here.
Yeah, I think so. And one of the things that we would deal with in the chancellor's office, of course, was when a dean's office had screwed up something, and then it sort of spilled out of the dean's office and spilled out of the college and came up to the chancellor's office because they had already made so many mistakes that we had to kind of take the case.
I guess the other point is that this is a practice which was convenient for the way David Ward felt, and you felt the university needed to handle certain issues, and so you developed this management structure to deal with the issues in this way. That necessarily would be unique to that administration at that time, but it's not always a template that is used with successive or previous administration.
I have no way of knowing, of course, how the chancellor's group, I'm assuming it's meeting or some form of it is meeting.
Yeah.
I know that it did continue while I was with John Wiley for 3 months, and it continued, and then it became much larger, and I don't know ultimately how that worked out.
Yeah.
Because we tried to have much larger impact, but we tended to do it with different groups, not all in one room.
Yeah.
And
you
know, just by communications vehicles. So I don't know how that, I can't imagine how that would work out. Because these, the chancellor's group meetings then organized the agendas in substantial part for the dean's meetings. So then we have, if we have the university relations team dealing with all of the external audiences and in the schools and colleges around the campus, people who get together because they have to explain to people who aren't at the university, whether it's the legislature or the general public, what it is that we're doing. So that's the university relations group. The chancellor's group is this small group. And then the academic issues find full flower, if you will, when the deans meet. And we had kind of two different formats for deans meetings during the time that I was in the chancellor's office. One of them was that it was just what it sounded like. The deans and the vice chancellors went off and had a deans meeting, and the agendas tended to focus on time to degree issues or whatever the issues were that were academic in nature that affected everybody. And then some of these other issues would spill over because the deans obviously wanted to have an opportunity to weigh in on some of the athletic or other issues that seemed to have an impact on the whole institution. So there was some overlap. And then as time went by, the dean's meetings were used, for example, to discuss our university relations strategy with the legislature and other things like that. And eventually some of the deans or some of the staff that worked with the deans said, well, gee, you know, maybe what we need is for the deans to have a time to just get together and reflect with one another and be deans. So then there developed and initially and for many years, we were using the deans meetings in effect as a management tool to get everybody to discuss the direction of the university and external audiences and all the rest of this. Then this other sort of, you know, I think there's always a, and this relates to does the current chancellor use this format or not, there's always a pendulum going back and forth here where all of a sudden maybe the deans don't feel like, maybe they feel that too many academic staff in the room who are telling them what to do and they get unhappy about it, so they say, okay, well, we just won't listen to them anymore. And so you go in this other direction, and then all of a sudden, 3 years later, you realize no one knows what the legislative strategy is, and so you go back in the other direction, and you get everybody in together to talk about it. And I think that there was a certain tension back and forth with regard to the dean's meetings and what they were designed to accomplish.
Now, one of the issues here, both with regard to the chancellor's staff and university relations, is who is the point person in terms of the public contact? And would you make those decisions? Sometimes you don't have the luxury of talking it through and then deciding. Sometimes it happens right away and you gotta find somebody who quite often says nothing, but is a voice at the moment, which then gives you a little time for the next time, but at other times the right individual can sort of contain the issue at the moment and interest goes elsewhere. So how often would that pop up?
I was never that person.
Yeah.
I was smarter than that. I didn't want to be the spokesperson for the chancellor or for the chancellor's office because they'd keep calling and I would never do anything else. Yeah. That's not quite true. I mean, from time to time I would do an issue, but and one of the general rules of thumb is you certainly don't want the chancellor being the point person.
No.
Because then they'll be asking all these embarrassing questions of the chancellor and that's not a good thing. So you'd find somebody else out there who was the right person, depending on the issue. For example, looking down at monkeys again on this on this agenda, you'd probably want the associate dean of the graduate school that was responsible for research involving animals to be that person, because they would understand what our monkeys ate for breakfast and how many of them we currently have in various facilities on campus. What is the rat population and all of the rest of this that no one else would have any reason to know. So they would be plausible then.
Right.
And so we would always have...
They would be monkeys' uncles.
So to speak.
Yes.
They would be somebody who would be very soberly talking about how we protect the rights of animals, but at the same time we're trying to solve cancer or whatever the arthritis or whatever the disease is. And you try to get it out of the chancellor's office altogether, in part because you don't want the monkey people sitting in your office all the time, which of course they did anyway, but it was, and monkey people drive around the country in vans. They're not pleasant people.
Yeah.
Anyway, so you try to figure out who was the right person, and with an athletic dispute or discussion, was it the director of athletics, or did you want the vice chancellor for legal, who at that time was supervising portions of the athletic program, to be the spokesperson? You'd always think that through, and who would be best with the legislature and so forth. And you'd try to find somebody who was not a professional PR person, because nobody believes them. And so you'd have to find somebody, just the right person. and then stick with that so that there was one person who commented. And when the newspapers would call the chancellor's office and I would say, I'm sorry, we got someone else working on this and I just can't talk about it. And then, you know, they'll grumble and growl and say, well, what's the matter? Aren't you a real person? And how come you can't talk about it? Are they trying to muzzle you? And you would say, oh, come on, you know. And then with the people who dealt regularly with the office, you would call from time to time and give them news tips. So you were sort of feeding them with one hand, and then when you had to tell them to get lost, they would understand it better than if you had no previous relationship with them. So we would have the local news reporters who were doing higher education come in, and we'd buy them a sandwich, and they could talk to the chancellor over lunch or something like that. So you gave them access when and ideas for what they might write about and tips and stuff. And so as long as you had this sort of mature strategy for how you would deal, and the same thing goes with legislators and their staffs. Charlie Hoslet would keep track of who all the legislators' staff members were, and he knew many of them, and he would call up and say, well, you're about to hear an embarrassing story about monkeys, or one of our employees has misbehaved, I want you to know what we're doing, or whatever it is. So you're doing this proactive inoculation strategy of not letting things just explode. And you'd figure out who needed to be called. And one of my jobs was to, you know, as one of these issues is going on, I would say to David, have you had a chance to call Catherine yet? Or somebody in system, you know, have you had a chance to call the president of the Board of Regents yet on this one? Because we would always make sure that, a little bit of information in advance goes a long way.
Yeah.
And we would call, believe it or not, and throughout most of the time I was in the chancellor's office, there were actually legislators friendly to the university, and we would call some of our friends and talk to them on the phone about things. So that's not only then do you establish the issue team, but then you figure out who needs to know about this. And sometimes we would have to give heads up calls. Almost all of these I made down to a dean to say to somebody, one of your employees has misbehaved, or, you know, because oftentimes we would be handling a case that really hadn't been called to the dean's attention yet, and you have to make those kinds of phone calls. But so you're always thinking, when you're in the chancellor's office, who needs to know this, and who's the best person to transmit the information, and can we get our legislative guy to start calling downtown right now so that we don't have all of those idiots saying something without having talked to us? And
well, did the view prevail, or does it prevail these days, that a lot of these issues are handled at the lowest possible level as opposed to being adjudicated within the chancellor's office? Sometimes the inclination is to throw everything up there, whereas the best judgment can be made in the area where people know the most about what's being discussed.
It's an interesting point, because while you're in the chancellor's office, you want to know that deans are confronting certain issues, but you certainly don't want to become a replacement for the dean, because you've got these people and you're paying them decent salaries, mm-hmm. and they should solve this themselves. And in fact, talking to Chancellor Ward, I think he would say that from time to time he had to become some dean's associate dean.
Yeah.
Because in effect, the level of detail that he was being asked to master and then make decisions on really was the job of the dean. And there were some deans who perhaps erred on the side of making snap decisions, but I think more often it was a dean who eventually had a tough one to call that was in the gray zone. And so the dean would say, well, gee, you know, I just don't know, what do you think, you know?
Yeah.
And that, and then David would eventually say, well, I don't want to be that guy's associate dean. And so that was the real problem. And this tended to be a problem more with outside deans that were brought in and they didn't understand the Madison campus And they really hadn't developed a sense of how to pull together a team in their own college to bring in an experienced executive associate dean or somebody or other of long standing who's going to help you out with some of this stuff. And that first year is pretty critical, and I think we still have a crappy way of welcoming new deans to the campus. And the private sector would be all over a new major manager with staff assistants that would, while not appearing to be running the situation, because you really want the new person to come in with ideas and actually some innovations or whatever it might be. But I think we just sort of say, well, good luck, and you might want to sign up for a seminar later to see about higher ed, you know, or whatever it is. And we don't have a...
Dean's Academy.
We don't have an academy, which actually here at the Higher Ed Center, when I was running it, we always wanted to establish. But you know, there were so many people in Bascom that thought that they should be the dean of the Dean's Academy, that the idea never made it anywhere.
We're talking about deans, but there are a few high-level directors also that need to be factored into this equation, because the responsibilities they have are quite similar to deans.
Yes, we always had Ken Frazier from the library system, very thoughtful, of course, at the dean's meetings, and we ultimately brought in the director of athletics. Mm-hmm. The foundation and alumni association continued to remain separate, though they were tied in by the university relations team at the time that we had them. They had senior vice presidents who were on the university relations team. Mm-hmm. Paula Bonner did it herself. Walt Keough was the vice president at the time of the UW Foundation, came to be on the university relations team, which was a recognition, I think, of the importance of that group. Mm-hmm. And also the financial support, because one of the things that we haven't talked about is the sesquicentennial. And in some ways, the sesquicentennial in 1998, once we remembered that we had to celebrate it, was a high watermark of public relations for the university statewide and with donors and with the legislature, because it was followed in the next biennium with the Madison Initiative, which gave us another $253 million, depending on how you add it up. And it represented the last major increase in the university's budget before all of a sudden it was Niagara Falls and you went over in a barrel. Support.
Can you talk
diminished.
A little bit about the Madison Initiative? What were the components of that, and what was the whole thrust behind getting the funds?
Well, the Madison Initiative was in some ways a Ponzi scheme, and was in some ways the addition of new money to the university's budget. It involved. The concept was, first of all, that we needed some additional resources, and this was the high watermark of a state investment in the university in certain specific projects. So the Madison Initiative was not just to give us another $200 million and we'll be happy, but there were some very specific things that the legislature was buying at the time. Improved undergraduate education. There were initiatives in three or four of the main components of what were in the university's long-range plan. Some of these were very exciting, because the Madison Initiative allowed additional undergraduate education initiatives, allowing students to graduate sooner. And in other words, they were thought-out proposals of what would be the outcome. And they were auditable outcomes. In other words, it was accountability.
See what you got for your money.
Yeah. So you give us this, and we'll do this, and we promise. And you'll see it. And it was also a public-private partnership, which is to say the university pledged to raise money to increase gift spending for the Madison Initiative as a part of the partnership with the state. So you had the Wharf Board and the alumni and the UW Board contributing funds for portions of the initiative that in effect leveraged state dollars, and it was very important. The whole the whole terminology, and this was not something utterly unique to Wisconsin, all across the country in various ways. In many states, state legislatures promised to match money that was raised, new money that was raised over the previous amounts that were being raised by the foundation of the flagship university in the state. And of course, many states wound up reneging on their promises to provide this match. They would they've fallen further and further behind. In some states, they're now 10 years behind in providing the money and so forth, because nobody had the heart to repeal the legislation, but the states ran out of money. So in those states, that was just, we'll give you a bunch of money when you raise a bunch of money over what you were raising before. Wisconsin's was much more sophisticated than that, and I think a more honest effort to try to, at the same time, cause bureaucracies and schools and colleges within the university to actually admit more students and to change their behavior and get people. I mean, there was a sense in which the Madison Initiative also looked inward and said, hey, we can do some of these things that we think are important.
Was that money a one-time appropriation, or was it then built into the base?
It was built into the base. And eventually, of course, the state stopped sending the money, and we stopped contributing the money, and the whole thing fell apart. But it was very definitely intended to be, because some of it started in the first year, and then some of it started in the second year, and it was intended to be at least a biennial program. And it was also predicated on the argument that the third leg of the stool, sort of, on the what were the arguments in favor of the Madison Initiative, really had to do with the fact that we were arguing that the university had new and exciting ways of doing things that it had traditionally done. And here we get into the whole question of cluster hires.
Yeah.
Because that's a new way of hiring faculty. And I remember David Ward's talks before the Bascom Hill Society and with legislators, where he would say, well, we're not just replacing the faculty who die with faculty who are now teaching what the person taught who's no longer here, but we are actually looking at new and creative ways that will make us more competitive for grants, make us, the instruction of tomorrow is not departmental, it's interdepartmental or intradepartmental, and we need to think of new ways of assembling teams of people who can work on thorny problems together and address things from this new perspective. And that'll improve education. And furthermore, we'll have research opportunities for undergraduates. And, you know, in other words, there was this new way of doing things which was a part of the... And that totally struck a responsive chord with donors and with others.
How about the faculty?
Well, I think it struck a responsive chord in certain quarters, because I think that people who tended to be specializing in the research enterprise understood that we were going to be competitive with NSF grants only to the extent that we were doing this.
Yeah.
They just weren't going to fund us otherwise. So there was obviously that there was a very clear case that didn't need to be made to the research faculty. I think that there was a sudden realization, and I remember the discussions that took place privately in the chancellor's office about this when we got to the second round of cluster hires, was that, you know, you were getting 312 applications from the biotechnology area, loosely from the hard sciences generally as a way of looking at it, and that we were getting very few applications from the arts and humanities or whatever, and that while this was working out swell, it was slowly leaving what I would call the liberal arts university behind. That was an area where, so that LNS and education were receiving fewer of those, or none of those proposals, or almost none of those proposals, and that they were all going off. Letters and Science was getting them in the sciences, but not in the arts part. So that needed to be corrected, and to a certain extent it was, which led David Ward, I think, to to increase funding for the Arts Institute to create a higher education research center, which became WISCE, which he started 3 years before he left as chancellor.